All right. Good evening. My name's Toby. I'm still an alcoholic. Tonight is quite a pleasure and a treat for me. We have a gentleman speaking tonight that I have the utmost respect for, having heard him in the rooms. Later, I was to find out that he had some other special qualities about bringing a clean and sober world, making a clean and sober world, which I'll let him describe for you. I've read some of his writings, and they're absolutely tremendous, and I'm truly looking forward to hearing him speak tonight. If there ever was a God-filled man, here he is. And without much further ado, Mr. George M.
My pleasure.
It's rather humbling. I'm just an alcoholic who has practiced this way of life thoroughly as I can. I practice it still every day. My name is George. I am a, I like to introduce myself sometimes as a born-again alcoholic. And I think that, you know, that's important that people realize that on page 62 of our big book, or 63, it says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. And it goes on down the line and it says, we begin to lose our fear of today or tomorrow or the hereafter. We were reborn. And, you know, so I say that sometimes. I'm at a little bit of a loss today. My hearing aids have gone out. I've got my backup hearing aid, but I'm deaf in one ear. It's really funny trying to talk and you can't hear yourself hardly. So just to bear with me, I have a little bit of speech impediment because I had a tumor removed from my ear back in 2008. I lost my hearing, I lost my balance, and I, you know, lost my ability to walk for a while. People who've had similar surgery, or that people in VA said, sometimes they just give up and quit. I said, well, I didn't know how to do that because I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for, you know, for 30 years. And it's not part of what you do. You don't lay down and start feeling sorry for yourself. It's just after a while you get out of all that stuff, you know. And so, anyway, I'm glad to be here. I don't know where to start, you know. I mean, you sit and think about, what are you going to say, you know? There's a whole bunch of stuff I could talk about, but basically I'll say my dad flew 25 missions over Germany, and he came back with a boar bride. The only problem, he was already married to my wife. He was an alcoholic. She shot him in the back down in Miami, and that was always something in the background which nobody ever talked about. A lot of shame, a lot of things covered up about that. My uncle years later told me that my father was the meanest man he ever met, and I wonder how could somebody be that mean, but apparently something happened to him as a child and he was mean, and so he got shot in the back, and I had a lot of shame about that. In fact, I ended up kind of following his footsteps. The only thing I remember about him is sitting on his, he went back in the Air Force, he was a colonel, but went back and came back after World War II as a master sergeant. He was wearing his uniform with his ribbons there, and 30 years later, or 20 years later, I guess, it's when I was about 25, I had my row full of ribbons, and I had my khaki uniform. I had been gone to Vietnam as a Navy officer on the Brownwater Navy, and I was there from 68, 69, 70. That's a whole nother story. I ended up marrying a girl whose father was a practicing alcoholic, and that was after completing University of Florida. I went to University of Florida, and I joined the Knights of Alcohol, Kappa Alpha Order. They were the drinkingest fraternity at the University of Florida. And in 1963, the Playboy magazine had a poll of the biggest amateur drinking schools in the country, and there was a little asterisk at the bottom. University of Florida is not listed here because University of Florida is considered a professional drinking school, and we thought that was great, you know. So we were the drinkingest bunch on the drinkingest campus in the world, and I drank my way through college. I didn't learn anything. Today it's the biggest shame that I can think of, that I never learned anything, and here I am 67 years old, and I'm reading things like philosophy and the history of the Western civilization, all that kind of stuff, trying to like catch up because there's some things, some more things that God wants me to write. I don't know enough. So, but I do know some basic things that are important. So I did learn about Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened is 1977, my wife left me, and she had good reason to leave me. I was a loser. I was full of self-pity. I treated her bad, and she picked up and left, took kids and left, and I went into one of those tailspins, and I went into those kind of jailhouse situations where you say, God, if there's a God, help me, and God showed up. Now, I didn't know what to do with God because, I mean, I didn't come from a religious tradition that knew anything about how you got suddenly born again. I've been brought up in Episcopalian down here at St. Andrew's Church downtown. My mother had been Church of the Nazarene, and there's my stepfather had been, his father was a druggist over here on Columbus Drive. He ran a thing called Pierce's Pharmacy. So he was a drug dealer. I mean, back in those days, those guys were dealing drugs. I mean, that's where you went to get your drugs, you get your cocaine, get all that stuff right there. And so my father, and he was an alcoholic, so my stepfather was also an alcoholic. So I had all that in the background. So I was coming out of a totally alcoholic milieu, and I was a mess. I cried out to God, and God showed up. I had one of those pink cloud experiences. You know, they talk about rocketed into a fourth dimension. I got rocketed into a fourth dimension, and I didn't have any context in which to deal with it. So I was a little crazy for a while, absolutely crazy. And so I ended up going to a place called West Georgia College. Now, West Georgia College was Andy Warhol graduated from the psychology school there. Can that give you a little drift on what this is all about? It was an outpost of the Esalen Institute. Everybody's smoking dope, doing drugs, and doing parapsychology and trance channeling and all kind of strange religions and all kind of stuff. I mean, I got totally into it, and I got out on the skinny branches of reality, and I ended up with my degree in Atlanta pumping gas and just not knowing what the hell was going on. I was so insane. I was also suffering, I didn't know this until much later, that I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I had been kind of in the middle of an explosion on my ship back in 60, right at New Year's of 69, and I didn't realize I was still suffering from shell shock. I didn't realize that. I mean, I suppressed it. It was down inside. And so anyway, I was going to figure this thing out. I was going to figure out what the spiritual experience was. I was going to figure it out, and I found out later it's not figure outable. It's just not. You can't figure it out. Did you know I was going to say that, didn't you?
Yeah.
You told him he's going to say it's not figure outable. Well, it's not figure outable. So here I am in Atlanta pumping gas, and bit by bit I go down, 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 until I end up basically homeless on the streets of Atlanta with my master's degree in psychology. I'm there living in a house that's being kind of, not yet ready for rehab, but it's a derelict house, and I'm sleeping on the floor. And this voice comes to me and says, have you thought about Alcoholics Anonymous? Now, this is really interesting because I've been kind of a whore for experience. You know, after this thing with this spiritual awakening, I've gone off to get my psychology degree. I've done all kind of strange things, you know, whatever people were doing, I got into it. And suddenly this voice comes to me and says, and see, I already recognize this voice. This is my higher power. When I had this spiritual awakening, I have a Christian background. I had a very loving grandmother, Mac, who prayed for everybody, and she was really a saint. She got an award from the Pope for her work with the cancer home back in 1968. And she prayed for me, but she had died while she died right after that explosion on the ship in Vietnam. And I never really grieved about her. And suddenly here I am, and I realize, I'm realizing there's some truth there. And it's like I saw the cross. And it was like on a black background with a green neon circle and this the cross sitting like that on the top of it. Now this is my experience. And I knew that I knew. I knew that I knew that I knew, and I knew that was going to be something true for the rest of my life. I started following this. I mean, I said, okay, I'll follow you, and I started following this voice. It would talk to me every once in a while, but it wasn't steady because I didn't really have a program, a spiritual practice. So this voice said, "What have you thought about AA, Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "No." He says, well, no. So I called up. I was obedient to do what it said to do. It said, call up. So I called up Central Office of Atlanta, and there was a meeting right down the street at the Presbyterian Church the next night. And I went down there, and I sat down in a meeting just like this. I think it was more than necessary. Speakers meeting, probably a step study meeting. And people were sharing. I went, you know, there's something in here that's, you know, this is really something, and I was changed by that. In fact, the very next day after that meeting, like, you know, wonder how God works in your life, I ended up packing my what I had left of my clothes and getting a car going down to Tampa, coming back here to Tampa. Came back home to my mother and dad, and my mother got me a new shirt and a new pair of pants, because all my pants had these little holes, and clothes had all these holes in them and stuff from hanging out with the hippies. And I went over to Axe Detox and got a job in detox, because after all, with a master's degree, you don't have to have any sobriety. All you have to have is a piece of paper, and they'll hire you back. They did then. Now I think people are a lot more smarter today than they were in those days. And I started in a career of working in drug rehabs of various types. And I didn't suddenly go to AA. I mean, I was driving the guys to AA at night, and you know, I'd watch what was going on there, and I could feel the presence of what was going on there. But I didn't really get it, that I really needed to work this program until about a year later, when I wasn't drinking. I mean, I'd been changed. Something had really touched me already. Just going to one AA meeting began to work on me, and I quit drinking, and I quit smoking funny cigarettes and doing stuff like that. And I finally came in on November the 14th. Well, that's the time of the day I can remember, November 14th, 1982. So I've got roughly gone this year. I got 31 years that I haven't drank. I haven't smoked any. I quit smoking cigarettes the same time. For a long time, I was going, if I quit smoking nicotine, do I have to quit smoking marijuana? Because is it really a cigarette? You know, all the crazy stuff that people do. But anyway. I came in and I started this program, and I started at Yana Club down in South Tampa. You know, I looked around for good sponsors. I mean, there's a guy named Joe, and you know, I got involved with this relationship with this married woman, and I tried to get out of it. And he says, "Well, if it feels good, do it." I said, "No, I got to get another sponsor." I got another sponsor, and he said, "Just stop doing it." But I realized I was also a sex addict. That comes later. I began to work the program, and I got a job working for I got a job doing neuromuscular therapy for a neurosurgeon and orthopedic surgeon, like deep tissue, like Rolfing. I did that for about 5 years. And now you talk about manipulation. See, most of us come in, we're pretty big manipulators, so I had a chance to kind of work out my need to manipulate people there. After that, I mean, after I moved from that, I said, I really do need to do something besides this. And so I got a job working for DACO. And I worked for DACO for a while back when it was on Caesar Street before it became a therapeutic community. Anybody go to DACO, go through their therapeutic community? How'd you like it? My experience, you survived it. My experience, I worked for Daytop Village up in Citra for a while. They went out of business, pretty sick place. The thing that I could say about this is they make smarter, faster rats. You know, I mean, you know, like you run through the maze, and people survive that. They become almost treatment impervious after that. If you go through a therapy meeting, you don't get well, you become really hard to treat. You know, it's really tough. When I say treat, you know, this is slightly different language than you normally hear from a speaker, because I'm a two-hatter. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm also a person who's worked in the field extensively. And that's a very awkward thing to do, because you're neither fish nor fowl. I mean, the people in rehabs don't like you because you're one of those damn recovering people. And, you know, and they're trying to teach people to make better choices. And you're saying they don't have a choice, and they're not going to have a choice. And so you're going against the whole intellectual, philosophical way that they come at things. And so, generally speaking, they end up firing you. And I worked, you know, and there's a lot of other things to say about that, but I don't need to go on. I worked at DACO for a while. Then I worked also at, ended up working at Zephyr Hills Correctional Institute, did a Tier 1 program right there until the warden got fired for getting involved with one of the inmates. Who, remember the guy got shot out here at the Cactus Club a few years ago with a .357 Magnum in his back pocket? Anyway, he was from that institution. They let him go to a law enforcement day, and he had some money in his pocket he got from a settlement for getting beat up down in Polk Correctional, and he escaped from the woman detective, the woman DOT worker that was guarding him, and he ended up out here and got shot. Well, anyway, when that warden was transferred, then they got a different warden in, and the place went to hell. Working in prison is really a tough situation. You think you're going to make a difference in prison, but prison is an environment that basically, you know, people are really like surviving in prison, and there's a lot of drugs in prison. There are a lot more drugs in prison than there is on the outside, drugs and alcohol. And it's a tough environment to really make a difference, change with people. For 14 years, I was down here at the little Tampa church down there. I guess it was Abundant Life Mission on Tampa Street for a number of years. I ran a group there 3 days a week. Whenever they fed people, I did a little stand-up speakers group with people, and that was kind of my outreach. That kept me sober more than anything else, is going watching those guys week after week after week, and trying to stay sober. I also worked at Daytop Village up in Citro. I mentioned that. I've thought about this thing. There's a lot to say, you know. At some point, well, for 4 years I worked with a fellow named Father George Clements in a program to get churches involved with supporting drug and alcohol addiction efforts in the inner city. It was funded by HUD, SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and I got involved in all the inner city churches and things going on here and trying to get people involved. Very tough deal. It's really hard to do that kind of stuff. And I put in on conferences where I brought in people who understood addiction, recovery, and all that kind of stuff. Didn't have a lot to show for it, but eventually what happened is I went to work for the Salvation Army. And of course, the Salvation Army has a history. Bill Wilson started a meeting with the Salvation Army up in New York City early in the early days of recovery, of the early AA. But unfortunately, like many organizations, Salvation Army's been in business for about 145 years, they've probably forgotten more than a lot of organizations have ever known. And unfortunately, they have gotten involved with, and I may step on somebody's toes here, but they've gotten involved with a thing called Celebrate Recovery, which they call it 12 steps, but it's nothing in common with AA and the way AA comes at things, although it looks like it, but it's not. And so I ended up writing this book to explain it to them. It's funny how it happens. People don't read stuff. You give them, say, here's the book that's going to explain it to you, and they don't read it. But it's okay, because what it did was it got it out of my system, and I was able to put it down in black and white. And basically, what I discovered along the way working in the Salvation Army is a way of explaining to people how AA has its roots in a Christian program. And of course, most of all of us know some of the stuff about the Oxford Group and Akron in 1935 and all that. And I put all this in the book, but basically, you know, a lot of the things that we think about in AA, is such as absolute surrender. Back in 1875, a woman named Hannah Whitehall Smith wrote a book called A Christian Secret of a Happy Life. And in that book, she says, you need to make an absolute surrender to God, and you need to turn over all your choices to God. Now, that's an interesting concept, because I tell you, say to people in AA today, I said, you know, I turned my will and life over to God, and I don't have my own will anymore. And I don't make my own choices anymore. And they go, you're crazy. I go, well, you know, I mean, I look at the third step. It says, I made a decision to turn my will and my life for the care of God. So then whose will is it now? I mean, now, if I go beyond saying it's God's will now and it's not my will and I gave my will to God, then I'm going to get into psychology and philosophy, and I start going down the skinny branches of an insane thought system, because if I gave my will to God, then it's God's will now. It's not my will. It's not my life anymore. The problem with all of us, and Frank Buckman said it, you know, the big book says it this way, is selfishness, self-centeredness at the root of all our problems. Bring up, you know, we're extreme examples of self-will running riot, although we don't think so. We don't think so. We had to get rid of self. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. We can't get rid of self without God's help. So here's the why, how and the why of it. We had to quit playing God. On page 14, it says, 13 starts talking about if we want to have a certain way of life, you know, we want to have a spiritual way of life. My friend promised when these things were done, I'd enter into a new relationship with my Creator. That was take my inventory, ask God to tell me what to do, make amends. Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things with the essential requirements. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. Destruction of self-centeredness. How many people are working on the destruction of self-centeredness in here? That's great. Because that's all this is about. People say it's about not drinking. No, it's not. I mean, like, yeah, okay, fine. You go say it's all about drinking. Not, I mean, I know if I try to tell you that it's about something else, you're going to tell me I'm crazy. But what this was the Oxford group, when they got started, and they say, carry the message to others, especially alcoholics. So Bill Wilson had this thing, this wonderful way of promoting and changing himself and other people, and he liked working with alcoholics because that's what he was, and those are the kind of people he could relate to, and he was such a low-down bum, nobody else wanted to listen to him except for alcoholics. That's like me. That's why I love working in rehabs, and I love working in rehabs with people who've been to rehab 20 or 30 times. I love them. I love it because they're the hard knuckle. You know, most of the guys, I say, why don't you just go get a sponsor and work the steps? And they go get a sponsor and work the steps. And they come in here and they do the program. And they come in. I see them in here. They got a sponsor. Like, I'll see Larry out here. I mean, I broke the anonymity, Larry. He's at the Salvation Army. But, you know, it's great. But I generally work with those guys that they always think, I got a choice. Because they go to NA. I think in the NA book, I've spotted it in there. I got a choice, I got a choice, I got a choice today. As long as I don't pick up that first drink, I got a choice. I go, no, you don't. I went up to Washington, D.C., and the whole center was overcome by that stuff. And we had to fire some people to get that out of there until we began to get the program back in. And there was, you know, we don't have a choice. I mean, I know that's a bad concept, but, you know, self, I put it in the book here, and I'm working on another book. You know, and people may not like to hear, you know, Bible stuff, but I'm going to say that when Adam ate the apple, he thought he was naked. I mean, he'd been naked the whole time. He looked down and he'd go, uh-oh. He had what is called self-consciousness. He began to see himself differently. And God said, well, who told you you were naked? The question is never answered, but the answer is he developed a self. He had a little voice up here that began to run his life and tell him stuff. And he became obedient to that voice. It's not the devil, it's self. Frank Buckman, who is the organizer of the Oxford group, said, sin is a three-letter word with I in the middle of it. The problem is we have this way of structuring language where the center of the language is always I this, and I that, and I this, and I that, and you never ever question it, nor do we ever make any attempt to undermine it and kill it off. And this book suggests ways of doing that. I'm working on another book that's actually a practical application of doing it step by step by step. But the Apostle Paul says in Galatians 2:20, he says, I've been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I. He's saying there's two natures. There's the old nature, that's the alcoholic or the sinner or whatever you want to call it. And then there's a new nature, which I get, but there's also a third nature that when we work the process over time, the church calls it sanctification, they never do it because they don't have a way of doing it because they don't have 12 steps. They don't understand it. They misunderstand it from the very beginning. And this is why the Western culture is in collapse right now. They don't have an understanding of this. The Western culture has developed a Greek philosophy, you know, and it was kind of developed over time. When it gets to 1500s, Rene Descartes says, and I see Toby going, his little voice in his head's going, I don't know if I believe this crap. I wonder if what he's saying is true. I can look. I've done so much group therapy. I can just look at people and go, I wonder what that's. What is he listening to there? He's not listening to me totally. He's listening to the voice in his head too. That's the self tension. Where'd I leave off?
The Greeks.
Descartes. Rene Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." And most people in the Western world, even if they say they're Christian or any other kind of religion, they're basically Cartesians. They're living as, I'm the thinker and I'm the chooser, and I have a sovereign free will. I'm the captain of my fate, the master of my own soul. And thank God for drug addiction and alcoholism. I mean, thank God for a problem bigger than we are, because if we never had a problem bigger than we are, we would never get this program. That's why I love working with and being friends with and being the fellowship of people who've been forced to take a look at themselves. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. Frank Bookman was a very nice Lutheran minister. He had been running a home for boys up in Overbrook, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia, and he was doing a great job working with homeless people, and people had addictions, and they made him run. They made him, you know, raise his own money and some other stuff, and they began to cut back what he was doing and began to mess with his out of resentment and quit in a huff, and he went to a place called Keswick, England, in 1908, and you heard a lady named Jessie Finn Lewis preach a message of the called the centrality of the cross. And what Jessie Finn Lewis had been doing for a number of years, she had been doing this thing called kind of like, God, kill me off. Just kill me off. God had said, you know, I'm going to crucify you. And she says, crucified? I don't want to be crucified. He says, well, you want to be really blessed? She said, yeah. I said, well, you're going to need to be. She said, okay, I'll be crucified. Well, anyway, in 1908, Frank Bookman comes along and this thing and do what I did. He goes and sits down, and she preaches this message, and he gets changed on the spot. Because it wasn't just a message, it was an experience. She had an experience of death to self. And that's the experience we have in here. I mean, it got passed down to us, however we relate it. And all this stuff in Word, we could probably read the phone book, you know, and as long as we gathered together and we had a common experience, we'd get something out of that. But we also have a story to tell. We have 12 steps to talk about. But there's an experience. There's an experience. And then she passed that experience on to Frank Bookman. And Frank Bookman took it and he started working in universities. He worked in Penn State University. He worked in, and he also, what he was doing also got up to Harvard and Princeton and places like that. But by the time he got started with this, the universities were already beginning to really crumble back in 1908. And sexual license was really beginning to creep in the Northeast. By the 20s, we had the Roaring 20s. This thing had really begun to take off. And these people were no longer interested in what Frank was doing. Frank was doing the four absolutes, you know. If your life is not working, you might take a look, you might have, he used the word sin, now we use the word self in AA, you might have some self going on, and here's how you find out how much self you have going on. You take a look at these four absolutes, and you you measure your life against the four absolutes, and when you come back tomorrow, you know, I will see you tomorrow, and you come back with a list of your stuff, I mean, where you don't measure up the four absolutes. And he began to do house parties all over the world. They would go in and change whole countries. Would get changed, Sweden and Denmark, and they've been a big sweep through Canada and whole cities like Toronto. Used to be known as Toronto the Good because Frank came through with his world-changing thing. He says the only thing that takes to be a world changer is pretty simple. You get up every morning and you use the four absolutes to measure your life against God's standards for right behavior, right being. And then, you know, give it to God. you know, I was talking to somebody at Sponsor a while ago. He's in AA, but you know, he's feeling depressed. He's feeling sorry for himself. I said, listen, your higher power took all that stuff. Why don't you just get real about this? And you know, your faith needs to be in the fact that it's over. It's not your stuff anymore. I mean, the seventh step is so important. You know, Bill worded it that we ask him to take it away. The reality that Bill had inherited was it's already been taken away. That's just the finished work of Calvary, was that sin has already been taken away according to the Christian motif. I mean, I've also been involved in Hinduism, and I'll share you the piece I got from living in an ashram for a while, because it sits right in with what I'm saying tonight. Then ask God for guidance to tell you how to carry the message to someone else. Frank Bubba wasn't interested in anything except you go change somebody else. And so, of course, Bill took that and go out and change another alcoholic, because that's the only kind of people he really knew how to work with, was alcoholics. At least he thought, I mean, he didn't know how to work with them either until he met Dr. Bob, and they figured out how to work together. Probably Bob taught Bill most of how to do it. He spent some time there, and Dr. Bob had a better manner than Bill did. There's a whole history. You know the whole history of that, and Clarence Snyder and all those folks. The thing that's probably most important to all this is to know a little bit of fact about a bunch of folks called the Plymouth Brethren. This is also all in that book. And I'm not trying to sell books. If you want to buy a book, fine. If you don't know, it's no big deal. But there's a group called the Plymouth Brethren. In the early 1800s, they really began to say that this whole idea of the way churches are organized was wrong. There's a guy named John Nelson Darby. He left the Irish Anglican Church, and he started to meet with a bunch of people called the Plymouth Brethren. And they tried to organize themselves without having any leadership, just to follow the Holy Spirit and to have God tell them what to do. They were never able to successfully pull off this organization because they were either too open or they were too closed. They got so open that they would let anybody in. The next thing you know, they weren't really dealing with what they needed to deal with, or they were so closed nobody could get in. Now, does that sound like the early days of AA? That's exactly, in other words, what AA did was through Frank Buckland. Frank Buckland had called this thing a world of first century Christian fellowship. He called it the Oxford Group. He said it was not really a group in the ordinary sense of things. It had no leaders. It had no organization. It was just people taking responsibility for changing the world. In other words, they took responsibility. He wanted to create teams of people where everybody was responsible. Well, Bill gets this. He starts AA. He's got a bunch of Oxford Group people in there, in the early AA. And as they begin to meet, they begin to notice some standard things that kept coming up in terms of conflicts. And he put all those together and boiled them down to 12 concepts to ensure our survival. They became the 12 traditions. But what Bill Wilson did, the great contribution, was not necessarily the 12 steps, because the 12 steps have been around for a long time in some form or another, in Benedictine order, and the Jesuits probably had one. The Jesuits always say, oh, that's exactly like Ignatius Loyola had that going on. Well, but the thing that they didn't have, that we have, and we have it almost uniquely, I mean, other groups are also 12-step oriented, but we somehow or another embodied this idea, and we really, it's the great power that we have here, is there's nobody in charge of this thing. So a bunch of people who are rebels don't have any of that authority stuff going on, because there's nobody to get bent out of shape with here. You have to deal with yourself, because there's nobody to rebel against. Isn't that interesting how God set that up? And this is absolutely a breakthrough. It's a context. They call it a first century Christian fellowship because before the church started getting organized in the third century, the emperor started paying people who were the leaders in the churches, and they became separate from the people, and they became a paid clergy, and the movement, the Christian movement, was never the same. Now, there were some surviving spots of this, like up in the mountains of Switzerland, a group called the Waldensians, but there were few and far between. It wasn't until the Reformation, Martin Luther wanted to, he had a sense that he needed to organize it differently, but he never had the guts to give it a try. I mean, he already had stuck his neck way out, you know, rebelling against, you know, salvation by works. He said it was by grace. So it wasn't until Darby came along, and it wasn't really until Frank Buckman started doing it, and he was not a theoretician. He was not a man who understood how to put the right things down. He didn't write anything down. So when Frank died, there was really no one to keep the movement going. So the Osher group, it became moral rearmament, then it became initiatives of change. They're just another organization that's making some feeble attempt at world reconciliation, and they've lost the joy. One of the things I got involved with got fascinated by the teachings of a guy named Dalavananda. He was a Lutheran altar boy. I've been affected by these Lutheran people. I'm not a Lutheran, but you know, Frank Buckman was a Lutheran, and this guy Franklin Jones was a Lutheran boy. He grew up in Long Island. He went to Columbia University. He was totally appalled at what he learned when he got to seminary, because they were kind of deconstructing Christianity. He really fell into a deep, dark hole, and he ended up going to California doing drugs. And before you knew it, after about 10 years, he became a guru named Dalavananda. And interestingly enough, there's a book called The Paradox of Instruction. If you really want to enjoy something, I suggest you read it. It's pretty good. He said, basically, you boil it all down to this. I'm the body. I'm the body. This is exactly opposite from the Greek point of view. The Greek point of view says, I'm not the body. And when I began to see this, and I got it in my book and in one of the chapters, is that Paul says over and over and over, don't you understand you're the body? Don't you understand you're the body? That you're individual members one of another? And this is what AA does, and it doesn't say it explicitly, but it says, when we come in here and say, I'm an alcoholic, once I say that, I enter into a oneness with you, that we are intertwined. We belong to each other. We're not just belong to each other. We're really in each other. Paul says in Romans chapter 12, he says, be sober according to the gift that's within you. But he says, don't you understand that you're one body and individually members of one another? This whole idea, he doesn't go into detail about sobriety, but he mentions sobriety on several occasions. And sobriety basically being God-guided. That's what Buck was trying to do. He was trying to get people to be God-guided and to learn how to have God speak to us. Now, I wrote this book, Absolutely Sober, and how I wrote it, I didn't write it. I woke up every morning, and I'd say, I'm powerless over this book, and my life is unmanaged. I don't know what to say. And I would take a look at what was going on inside me. And I call this, by the way, I left out a piece. In 1986 and 1988, I went to the former Soviet Union to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got this, God spoke to me and said, you should go to the Soviet Union to carry the message. Somebody like, you know, Werner Earhart was going there carrying the S train over there, so I should go. So, sure enough, I called them here and said, there's a trip leaving 2 weeks from now. You need to get your money in the day. So I called out and I called some neighbors up, some friends up from church. Hey, I need $1,400 to go to Russia. They said, well, I can't get it right now. Can you give us till this afternoon to get it? Yeah, sure. So anyway, I went to Russia in 1986, 1988, carrying a message. I carried the big book to a guy named Vladimir Sergienko Vodka, and he got sober. A year later, he came over to the United States. He got sober, and it was a great thing. I saw the name was called Creating a Sober World. That was the name of the group that went. They were out of the Esalen Institute, out of California. And I started saying, well, look, I'm creating a sober world. I don't know how to do that. I'm just one person. And God said, well, you know, you may not ever do anything to get the world sober, but guess what? It's going to finally get your ego down to where it needs to be. It'll be a great way for you to work the program. That phrase has helped me a lot, because a lot of times in rehabs, especially in Christian rehabs, people say, I don't want to say I'm a drug addict. I don't want to say I'm an alcoholic. You get all that stuff, you know, the power of positive speaking, and you don't want to affirm things that aren't true, and all that nonsense. I mean, the Apostle Paul says, most gladly, therefore, I'd rather boast about my weaknesses. The power of Christ would dwell in me. So I say, you know, I'm so bad I'm an alcoholic. Why? Because when I enjoy my weaknesses. You know, I've become all things to all people, that I might win some to God. Creating Civil World began to be something I used to do workshops with people, and one of the things that I would do that we generally wouldn't get when you get generally get guys that have already gotten past denial and resistance to treatment. They've already been beat up. One of the things that you have to do when you work for a place like DACO is you have to be the guy that brings them to the bottom, so that you have to really deal with all that fight they got in them and all that denial they got. But some of the things that we deal with was don't tell me what to do, don't hurt me, don't betray me, don't shame me, don't embarrass me. Of course, if you work with a sponsor that you get right out of the tank, you know, then you know that you have to do that with people. And also, there's the guiding beliefs, which is, I got to prove myself, I got to figure it out, I got to be right, I got to protect myself. I already said I got to figure it out. These things drive people, and this is one of the compulsions that we have. You know, AA is not philosophical at all. When I say that in AA meetings, say down in Sabrina down here, I get guys, get up and walk out. They get pissed off because they have a big investment in what it means. And, you know, and it's really tough that it doesn't mean anything. I mean, meaningless, and it doesn't really mean anything that doesn't mean anything. We're so addicted to meaning. People may be getting shook up on this one. But we're so addicted to meaning that everything has to mean something. In fact, philosophy, the whole enterprise of philosophy, I'm reading Heidegger right now. He's trying to find out what the meaning of being is. I said, why is he wasting his time trying to find out what the meaning of being is? Why don't you just try to find out what being is? You don't have to find out what it means if you find out what it is, you know? I mean, it's just crazy, you know, what people do. And that's what we're dealing with. We're living in a world that that is just philosophically bankrupt. I've been reading books by guys who are big philosophers at Harvard and Yale, and I read their books, and they're absolutely lost. They have no clue, and they see it collapsing, and there's not one darn thing they can do about it. It looks like, you know, well, sometimes I say, well, I've been creating a Civil World. I'm doing a really great job because it is hitting bottom. I've done a good job, right? But, you know, you just direct the traffic in the direction it's going. That's how you do it when you step out in the intersection. If you're a good traffic cop, you go, it's hitting bottom. You know, that's where it's going. I don't know, this is not how I imagined this talk to go, and I've got 10 minutes, and basically, what I'll sum it up this way, I'm dead. I know I don't look like I'm dead. This is what they were studying at Keswick in 1908, is that Romans 6, 3 and 4 says, don't reckon yourself to be dead. Paul says, God forbid that I should glory, save in the cross of Christ, my Savior, by which I've been crucified in the world, and the world crucified me. I am dead. I'm the body. I you know, he lives inside me, my God lives inside me. The big book affirms that, you know, so much that we have this relationship with God. I no longer live. You know, I'm living the yet not I life. It's really not about me. It's really not about me. I mean, I'm just walking in the Spirit. And that's a position that they were taking. That word position really comes out of Keswick, is they took a position that when Christ was crucified 2,000 years ago, they were crucified with it. That's what they were doing. But that's totally lost in the church today. They don't see it, they never understood it, they never got it, because the tendency of people is to, this idea that I'm myself is so strong that it's real hard, and people take and they intellectualize everything. They may get some wonderful insight into things, but we know that idea of insight has to be smashed. If they don't get out of the idea that they're not themselves. And it's only when a person comes in and they admit complete defeat, and they come in here and they say, I need help, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. We enter into a fellowship where self doesn't have a lot of room. It may even survive for a while. It may even survive for years. I mean, I saw a guy at Serenity not long ago. He said, I was sober for 20 years and I picked up again. I said, well, let me ask you a question. Do you have a choice about it? Picking up that next, oh yeah, I got a choice about it. I pulled out the big book and I showed him page 24 in the big book, and he wasn't interested. So, what can you do? You know, you hear things like three frogs on a lily pad and one decided to jump off. How many frogs on a lily pad? What's the answer to that question? 3 foot axle on the lily pad, one inside to jump off, how many on the...
Three.
Huh?
Three.
Three, well, you know, a lot of times here with you, you've already passed the test, I've already done it in here. Don't say two, he only made it, you know, three, he only made a decision. He only made a decision. Well, a decision is a work of, it's a, what a decision is it comes from the word desideri, to cut. Somicide, suicide, pesticide, insecticide, something dies. So if the frog is on the lily pad and he decides to jump off, he jumps off. That's called a decision. It's not something we do in our heads. It's something you do on your knees. That's what they did up in Akron. They took him upstairs, so it would be a ceremony. They'd walk him up to the side of Dr. Bob's bed, and they'd get him down on their knees on the side of the bed, and they made a decision. In other words, they went through a thing where they get, I did that. It wasn't something they did in their heads. And that's why most people, in other words, there's a cutting away. There's a reckoning that I'm giving my will to God, and that's it. And it's over with. I don't have my own will anymore. People say, I took my will back. I said, would you give the doorknob? And you went over and twisted the doorknob, and it coughed it up. Is that what you did? Who'd you give your will to? Did you give it to God, or what kind of God did you give it to? You give it to an Indian taking God, or he takes it and then gives it back to you, an Indian taker? Different from an Indian giver. These things are important that people understand. You know, the problem I have had with Celebrate Recovery is, you know, they say, Celebrate Recovery. Well, you know, real drug addicts and alcoholics do not get sober in Celebrate Recovery. Why? My name is John, and I struggle with alcohol. I go, man, alcohol whipped your butt. What do you say you struggle with it? You should say, who cares to admit complete deceit? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against out of personal powerlessness. Have you admitted complete defeat yet? And then the other thing they say is we made a commitment to follow God. I said, listen, you know the difference between the, you know what happened with the chicken and the pig were asked to provide the fixings for breakfast? The chicken made a commitment, the pig made a decision. Did I get that? The chicken brought the eggs, the pig brought the bacon. You see, the question is, what are we bringing to the meal? Are we bringing the bacon or are we bringing the eggs? You know, because you can always lay some more eggs. A lot of us do for quite a while until we decide to give it up and bring the bacon. Anyway, that's my story and I'm sticking to it. Thanks for bearing with me. Thanks for listening. And does that, anybody have any questions? Because we're down. Is that time? Question time? Oh, you handle that.
Yeah, I handle
it. You conduct that. Okay. Good. I'm sorry.
Give it up.
You're through. Get
Thank
the hook.
You. There you go.
Okay.
George M.